Today in Studio 360, it's kind of a DIY day. We'll reveal the winner of our photo remix listener contest. Our judges went through more than 600 of your submissions to pick the winners, and they were nice about it.
It was a lot of fun to look at them. We were absolutely surprised by the different combinations of things that people came up with.
And we'll hear about a new album of 20 fresh Beck songs. But there's no CD, no download. If you want to play these Beck songs, you've got to play and sing them yourselves. So that's what we did.
From the Broadway musical.
Exactly.
Coming to you from 360.
20 years after his slacker anthem, Loser, Beck still knows how to be interesting. I'm Kurt Anderson. I'll talk with Beck today, and there's much more ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, the EEG goes from serious medicine to mass market fun. We'll hear how artists and designers are using headsets that read your mind. And the singer-songwriter Beck has just released a new record without singing any of the songs on it. It's all sheet music. So, thanks to Beck, a few of my colleagues and I got to play Rockstar for a day. We'll see what Beck thinks of our version of one of his songs when I talk to him a little later.
Hell yes.
But first, 2013 is shaping up to be a big year for musicians and writers and other artists who had hits in 1978. I'm calling it the copyright cliff, because back in the 70s, Congress passed a law that allowed artists to take back any copyrights to work they sold to publishers or record labels or whomever after 35 years. And that 35 years is up a week from Tuesday. As it happens, 1978 was an excellent vintage in pop music. Pump It Up by Elvis Costello. The Promised Land by Bruce Springsteen. Patti Smith's Because the Night. And Shattered by the Rolling Stones. Lita Rosario is an entertainment lawyer who represents musicians. She's using what's known as the termination clause to help some of her clients, including members of the 70s funk band Parliament, recover copyrights. Lita, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello.
So the record industry has been in decline and fall for more than a decade. Is it now going to get shattered even more, to coin a phrase? For a typical label, is this backlist revenue an important stream for them?
Oh, absolutely. Catalog music actually generates more money for the record labels than new music. And you can see that if you look at the Billboard Top 200 album sales. Uh-huh. Most of the product on that is the best of, you know, the Beatles, best of James Brown, best of albums. So catalog music is actually very, very important to record labels.
So if artists and successful artists from back in the day begin claiming their copyrights for 78 and then 79 and then 80, this is a serious threat to labels.
Well, I would say that it's a threat, yes, absolutely. It's basically another factor that's going to go into how this industry is reshaped.
Right.
And it's not going to mean the end of the record labels, but yeah, they're going to have to figure something out for sure.
And, of course, as I understand it, this isn't going to happen automatically. Artists have to,
right.
A, know about it, and B, submit forms to register their reclamation rights.
Right. Well, they have to first send a notice to the current owner of the works, and many times the works, the ownership has changed over the years. So they have to do kind of equivalent of what we would think of a title search in a real estate situation. Find out who the current owner is, and they have to send out notices, and the requirements of the notices are very particular and very specific. And if the notice is not correct, the termination will not be effective.
So this is definitely good for artists. Sounds like it's also good for lawyers.
Yeah, it sounds like one attorney called it full employment for copyright lawyers.
Yeah. Back in 1976, why did Congress add this clause? It wasn't an obvious thing.
The legislative intent was to allow artists to get a second bite at the apple, to give them an opportunity to negotiate for their work after the value of the work has actually been realized.
So if an author, artist, whomever, doesn't do anything now and they have a certain period of time, they're just out of luck, right?
Yeah, they'll be out of luck. So it's very important for them to know and be aware that their rights are ripe and that they need to be exercised and that they're exercised properly so that they can get the real benefit of them.
You represent the estate of Gary Scheider, who was one of the songwriters and guitarists in Parliament. Which songs is the estate trying to reclaim?
Basically all the songs, but it includes Atomic Dog, one of the big ones, One Nation Under a Groove, Flashlight. So there's a number of very popular songs, and I've actually am now also representing George Clinton regarding that as well. That's a new development. So
Parliament and Funkadelic. You're recapitulating history, personally.
Yes.
The Copyright Act, as you say, applies to more than just musicians. It's photographers, writers, any kind of authored work. And you're an intellectual property lawyer in other realms than music. Is music where it's going to hit the hardest?
It's going to hit book publishing pretty hard, too, if the notices actually come in.
Right. My first book came out in 1980, so I guess I got a couple of years to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
I mean, you can send your notice now, just for your audience's sake. You can send a notice of termination no more than 10 and no less than 2 years before the effective date of termination.
Uh-huh. So it's not like something you have to do tomorrow.
Exactly.
So for people who buy records or buy books or any of this stuff, is this going to have any effect at all, or is it all a backroom arguing over the money thing?
Well, I think it's a backroom issue for, you know, consumers who buy music, but it's a front room issue for people who want licenses, for film production companies, for including small independent film companies, because small independent film companies have traditionally had a very difficult time getting licenses to use music that's owned by the major record labels. But recording artists are much more likely to let smaller businesses, digital-based businesses, license their music and get access to the music, whereas the major labels and major publishers are very restrictive about that.
That's an interesting point. So it could help culture in that way.
Yes, absolutely.
Lita Rosario, good luck and thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Lita Rosario is an entertainment lawyer based in Washington, D.C. So what do you all think? Is it fair that after 35 years, any musician or author can get back their copyrights from the companies that paid for them? Leave us your comments at studio360.org. A couple of weeks ago, we gave you all a challenge. The photographers Jerry Uelsman and Maggie Taylor provided 10 photographic elements for you to assemble into your own compositions. And hundreds of you responded, making fantastic and generally fantastical works. You can see them all at studio360.org. We got more than 600 submissions. Jerry and Maggie judged all of them, and they are back in the studio now to tell us whose they liked best. So, Maggie and Jerry, thank you for doing this. It was a huge undertaking, huger than any of us knew.
We were totally overwhelmed that there were over 600 images that people sent in. It was a lot of fun to look at them. We were absolutely surprised by the different combinations of things that people came up with.
It's just amazing the variety of results that they were able to create just using these same elements, essentially.
No, you're like two gods who created the universe and then waited to see what the humans would do with what you'd created. Maggie, were you surprised at some of the ways that people combine these elements?
Well, you know, at first when I picked out the images Jerry and I selected to provide for the contest, we had no concept that people would try to combine every single one together.
Yeah.
And some people did. I mean, there were some people who used only one or two elements and some used all of them. So the whole thing was rather eye-opening.
Yeah.
Things were used in ways that we never imagined.
Well, and you guys agreed on one big winner, but you each had a different runner-up. So, Maggie, you first. Tell me about your runner-up and why you chose her.
Well, I chose the image that I chose as the runner-up, which was called the Tree Hugger, because I like the character that this artist created. And he's got a forest growing out of the bowler hat. Just, it's very, very streamlined and elegant, and she's subtly altered the colors and pulled everything together with a texture, and it just struck me as very nicely done.
Yeah, her name is Cindy, and it is nice. It's. I have to say, I mean, when I saw the two runners-up that you guys chose, the one you chose, Maggie, is sort of more like your work, and the one that Jerry chose is sort of more like his work. Jerry, tell me about the runner-up by a guy named Joseph that you chose.
Well, again, I guess we were attracted to the bowler hat, which in one of the images occurred on your head, of course. But this image has a guy emerging just at eye level out of this dirt road. And I don't know, it's just the idea that someone could conceive of, you know, cutting it off at that point and making it somewhat believable that he's looking out on this landscape. And the title was something that said, "Behold the Secrets of the Forest." And then he's given it an overall sort of sepia tone, which is somewhat of a reference to early photography, and has managed to include separate elements, the guitar, the stone head, there's one butterfly, and then a flock of birds.
Yeah, the flock of birds sort of that one doesn't see at first that's over there in the rear left is really lovely and gives some sort of kinetic feeling to the thing.
And that person has done an excellent job with all of the shadows. It just really works.
Yeah.
Maggie became more the technical expert in terms of she knows enough about Photoshop. And when some people accomplished certain technical skills at a high level, she was very much aware of that.
Yeah. Well, there's also in the big winner, the one you chose, on which you agreed, there's also a nice shadow. Maggie, describe this picture by an artist named Rhett Rebold.
Well, what Rhett has created is a sort of bird as flying machine. So he's taken the blackbird that we provided and nicely enhanced it with a little cockpit and sort of an antique pilot, which I think is a woman, but it's sort of hard to say. It's a sort of...
I'd say it's a woman. I'd say it's an Amelia Earhart-ish person.
Yes, complete with the leather bomber jacket inside of the bird. And then in the background, you see a giant blimp coming over, which everything, just the scale of the whole thing is surprising and fun and wonderful.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's one of these images that when we first saw it, you know, you laugh out loud. It's so loony, but at the same time, it's presented in such a cohesive way visually that it just engages you at all kinds of levels. And then I get always amazed by how someone could think of this. I mean, where does this come? You know, looking at those elements to be able to come up with this is an amazing task.
Well, let's give Rhett Rebold a call where he lives outside of Washington, D.C., and find out how he came up with it. And he doesn't know that he's won, so we're going to let him know.
I hope he's
home. All right.
Hello?
Hi, is that Rhett?
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
Hi, I'm glad to meet you.
Well, thank you very much for participating and submitting your picture. I'm here actually with Jerry Yulsman and Maggie Taylor. And in fact, Jerry, why don't you go ahead and tell him how you guys judged his picture and what you thought of it?
Well, after looking at all 600 and plus images, yours was the one that we really most intensely responded to. It's just, it has a kind of quirkiness to it. It's certainly well done, well crafted, and was engaging. And we kept coming back to it. And it's, in our opinion, the winner.
Wow. I'm blown away. I'm really humbled.
Well, Jerry said that he and Maggie laughed out loud when they saw your picture. When you saw these 10 disparate elements that didn't necessarily suggest an antique female pilot in a bird with a dirigible, what led you to come up with this notion?
Well, you know, it was partially planned and partially accident. You know, my dad was a pilot. I like aviation. I like Zeppelins. So I just happened to have a really great shot of, I think Netta was her name, contemporary of Amelia Earhart, and such a great shot. And I was actually thinking of sticking her in the dirigible, and I drug it across the Crow, and it's like, oh, wow, that's way better, you know? Crow as aircraft, you know? It made me laugh. So, yeah, so that became kind of a theme.
I think, you know, it's a very successful image. The one tiny suggestion I would make that doesn't really alter it much, but I think the Zeppelin should be a little bit smaller. And if you move it up a little higher in the sky and give it a level of almost transparency, because it will enhance the space. There's great spatial quality already in the image, but if the dirigible is up there and a little fainter and smaller, that would help it. And I would, I'd hang it on my wall.
Well, and the thing I thought of, Rhett, when I saw it as an author who's always thinking about, what should this next book be? It would be a great book cover. I don't know what the book is, but I would alert all authors and publishers out there to take a look at Rhett's image if you're looking for a cool book.
That's great.
Book
I appreciate track. The endorsement. Yeah. What would the book be? Things Can Get Weird.
Thanks so much for doing this and participating.
You did a great
job. Well,
my
pleasure. I'm really honored and, you know, nice to hear from you guys.
And Jerry and Maggie, thank you so much. And you didn't know what you were in for when we said, judge these pictures.
It was, we didn't talk about the stress of us deciding, we agreed on most. And then there was a point at which we almost needed counseling.
I was worried about that we were going to be the pretext for some marital bickering.
Yeah, right. Well, and there's also a part where you feel like you're a pig in a bacon judging contest.
But
suddenly we're so close to these images.
We agreed 100%. On the winner, though, so that was the easy part. We just kept coming back to that one, and that was a no-brainer, so that was good.
Right.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can see Rhett's image and the runners-up at studio360.org. Plus, my special favorite and the favorites of the whole Studio 360 team, along with all the rest of those 600 entries. Thanks again to everybody who shared their work. It was awesome to see what you came up with. The contest is over, but we'll keep Jerry and Maggie's 10 photographic elements available on our website for your continuing remix pleasure. Now, I've done some odd things on this job. I once got into a human-sized hamster wheel to interview a choreographer, but I wasn't expecting to play the Glockenspiel. I play percussion on a new song by Beck. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
One more take to get that last note a little better.
Alrighty.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It's never been easy to pin down what kind of music Beck makes. He started out with four edgy folk rock albums and then released Odelay, one of the first rock records that went ultra-digital, embracing hip-hop and sampling and glitchy noise.
She's got a cigarette on each arm. She's got the lily-white cavity crazes.
After that, he got funky, then a little mopey. Sure, he's alternative and indie, but what do those mean? Eventually, it became impossible to have expectations for a new Beck record. And that brings us to Beck's latest album, which sounds like nothing yet. Song Reader is a collection of sheet music, 20 songs beautifully printed and packaged with original artwork and musical notation for different instruments. Beck has not recorded or released any of these songs yet, so if you want to hear them, you got to play them yourself. Think of it as the ultimate DIY music project. And Beck is here with me now to talk about it. Beck, welcome to Studio 360.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
So in keeping with the spirit of Song Reader, we actually assembled a bunch of the staff here at New York Public Radio in Studio 360 this week to record one of the songs, Saint Dude. And I want to play it for you.
Love to hear it.
So that was some of the hosts and staff at WNYC and WQXR playing Saint Dude from Beck's Song Reader.
From the Broadway musical. Coming
exactly.
to you from 360.
Right, right?
It felt like that. It was something very triumphant. And yeah.
And that was me on Glockenspiel, by the way.
Nice work.
Thanks. So since you haven't yet in any public way performed these or recorded these, when you wrote that song, is that rendition entirely different from what you were thinking as you wrote it?
I think when I played it, it had a little bit more of a pensive bridge over troubled water.
Yeah.
You know, but I like that version. I think that's one of the aspects of this project was to hear your own songs back in different ways that you hadn't expected or, you know, thought possible. And I'm feel like I'm learning a lot hearing these songs played back at me.
And even though the album has just come out, there are already many, many, many versions that have been submitted to your songreader.net site and posted on YouTube and SoundCloud. Have you listened to many?
I have. I mean, the ones that have been posted, I've watched at least a dozen of them so far.
Are there versions you're hoping to hear that you haven't heard yet? Not that we want to stack the deck and say, oh, do that rap version of Old Shanghai. But
You know, the more far out, the better, I say. You know, I really feel like the sheet music versions are just really a rough sketch of what it could be.
Yeah.
Of course, people can play them as they're written. But, you know, as, whenever I get a song remixed, I'm always happy to hear something completely unexpected.
No, and it's to sort of have nothing but cover versions, so to speak, from the beginning is what's sort of so interesting about this.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, it's maybe strange, but really that's what songs were originally. I think it's probably difficult for people to even imagine a time where there weren't records and recorded versions of songs.
Right.
And we probably don't realize how alive and thriving that world of sheet music was.
Mm-hmm.
The way these songs were bought and sold and played in people's homes and shared among friends and family. It's really, it was a big part of the social glue.
Sweet Leila, heavenly flower.
You said that discovering the sheet music from the 30s for Bing Crosby's Sweet Leilani made a big impression on you. How so?
Well, I had just stumbled on this fact that one of his hit songs, and he had many, I think he has the most number one songs of all time. I mean, he was a hit machine.
Before the Beatles, before Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the exact number, but I mean, it makes the Beatles and Elvis pale in comparison. And he had one song that was so popular, it sold 54 million copies of sheet music.
Wow.
In a time where there were only 120 million people in the entire country.
As you were thinking about writing these songs from the beginning, you must have thought, okay, these aren't custom made for me like most of the songs I've made. So what did that lead to?
Well, you know, listening to a lot of these classic songs, whether it's a Tom Petty song or, you know, an Elvis song or Beatles tune or Cole Porter, some of these really classic songs have a really simple lyric. And this is something that I've thought about a lot. You know, I hear a song and think, man, if I wrote that, I don't wonder if I could get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
People do, but I guess I felt like I could take liberty and write some things that were much more simple and direct in the way those songs, you know, whether it's a Love Me Do or Love Me Tender, Love Me This, Love Me That.
Yeah. Having done this and having focused so many hours on writing in this new way for you, will that change the way you do music going forward?
I hope that this gives me, on the one hand, a kind of discipline or being able to think of that songwriting craft in a way where you don't have to get so precious or up in your head about it. You can really look at it as a bigger tradition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And certain songs become so big over time, you forget who wrote it or who sang it. It just becomes part of a sort of collective, you know, idea of song.
You talk about how music becomes part of the musical culture. It seems to me that can be said of your music from the 90s, certainly. Mm-hmm. Odelay is part of the soundtrack of the 1990s. I want to play a song from that album, Where It's At.
There's a destination a little up the road from the habitations of the towns we know. A place we saw the lights turn low, the jigsaw jazz in the get fresh flow, pulling out jobs and jamboree handouts, two turntables and a microphone, bottles and cans, and just clap your hands, or just clap your hands.
Where is that?
And that's a song from the 90s about the music of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
As you were doing that album, did you feel like, okay, this will have enduring influence?
No, I don't think so. You know, I mean, at that point, I was just amazed that I was able to be in a recording studio recording yeah. songs, you know.
And so you were just happy to be there and didn't think, I'm a big deal now?
I've never had that.
No.
I wish I had a little of that. You know, I've noticed that any song that connected with people or got on the radio in the studio, there was no sense of anything important happening at all whatsoever. If anything, the song was a bit of a throwaway, you know.
So it wasn't that biopic moment where they said, kid, this is going to be a hit.
No. We did a record called Sea Change, and there was a song called Lost Cause, and that song got on the radio, and it was just, I almost took it off. It just felt like a throwaway. You know, it was definitely not the song that
it was a B-side.
We paid much attention at all. No.
Baby, your love. Baby, your love.
I can't think, however, of any other musician around today who has been able to so successfully drop into such disparate-seeming genres, again, doing it so interestingly over and over again, from folk rock to hip-hop to R&B. I want to play a little bit of your song, Deborah.
'Cause when our eyes did meet, girl, you know what was packing heat.
I mean, you wouldn't think, oh, the guy who did Loser did that not long after. Did it seem early on like you had to make the choice whether, okay, I've got this hit, I'm going to keep doing songs more or less like that, or I'm going to be a guy who does sort of radically different things?
You know, it's funny when you're in a studio, you know, things happen. You really, I have rarely gone into the studio with that as a sort of, you know, thinking about the bigger picture, you know. It's just very much just whatever is happening in the moment. And if you're just doing something and letting loose and everyone's laughing or, you know, having a good time, then that's, you know, probably the difference in my output is I had tend to put those songs on the record, you know, whereas you know, maybe other bands are doing stuff like that, but they keep it to themselves, you know, they kind of play it straight. I think that I never really try to make a cohesive body of work because I didn't really think I'd have a body of work or that anybody would be interested. So, you know, just kind of let whatever happen. And I was, you know, as a solo artist, you know, I had that agency to be able to kind of do whatever I wanted and go where I wanted, and I didn't really have...
You didn't have to convince band members to do it?
Yeah, which I think most people do, and maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe my music would be a lot more consistent and better for it, but, you know, it is what it is, so...
Well, I, for one, am glad it is what it is and that you give yourself the leeway to make projects like The Song Reader. It's a really cool thing, and thanks for talking with me about it today.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the interest.
Beck's new album is a set of sheet music called Song Reader. You can see me playing on one of those songs, Saint Dude, with some of my actually and extremely talented colleagues. The video is up at studio360.org. And that ringer on lead vocals is our engineer, John Delore. We performed a couple of other Beck songs from the new sheet music album, and you can hear those too. As 2012 comes to an end, we're thinking ahead to 2013. Is there some creative project or challenge you've been meaning to bite off for years?
Hi, this is Linda Brewer. I'm an aspiring writer, and I have made a resolution that this year I will write a short story and send it out every month of the year. I'm 66 years old, and I've decided it's about time I fulfilled my promise before I creep into the grave.
So let's make this the year to get it done. We're here to help. Tell us your goal on our website or by calling this number, 646-580-0360. That's 646-580-0360. We'll pick a few of you to check in on over the course of the year and see how you're coming along. That number, once again, is 646 580-0360.
We'll take a cup of kindness, yeah, for anxiety.
In a minute, we'll hear about a new wave of gadgets that you can control with your mind. But be careful, because they also make it possible for your mind to be read.
This is a way for somebody to actually see your own state and get a signal and open a channel to you that wasn't there before.
High-tech neurology in the toy store. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. And by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish music, fun, culture, and lots more. For those interested in uncovering their roots, renewing a love of Ireland, or discovering it for the first time, more information at discoverireland.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. You may have recently seen a toy called a Star Wars Force Trainer. Come to think of it, you may have recently been obliged to buy that toy. It uses a wireless headset that reads your brain waves, and if you concentrate hard enough and in the right way, you can make a little ball levitate, like Luke Skywalker using the Jedi Force. This is the breakout season for mind-reading gadgets. They've all got some kind of headband with electrodes that pick up the electrical activity in your brain using EEG technology, which has been around for decades. But only now is EEG finding its way into the hands of designers and artists. Studio 360's Mark Anderson checked out some of them.
I'm watching a video of a performance that took place earlier this year. A man with a white beard is hovering in the air. He looks a little like Michelangelo's vision of God, and he seems to be having a religious experience. He's in the middle of a giant soundstage, and he's hooked up to a winch high up on the ceiling. God's eyes are closed, and he's bathed in a gently pulsating white light, and he's gradually rising toward the ceiling. Then a bell clangs, and a fanfare rings out through a giant stack of speakers. Mussorgsky, God has ascended to the rafters. After a burst of confetti, he's lowered back to the ground. This is a piece of interactive theater called The Ascent.
It was like Leonardo da Vinci meets Raymond Kurzweil meets George Lucas.
That's Yehuda Duenas, clearly not a man of modest vision. He created The Ascent.
The kernel of the idea is very interesting, but what I like about it more is what we've done with it, beyond just the straight up and down.
Each ascent lasts 4 to 8 minutes. The rider is connected to a winch, and he's wearing an EEG headset with two electrodes. That headset is connected to a computer, which is controlling the winch. The goal is really to meditate, despite the dazzling light show and booming soundtrack. If your mind is relaxed, the electrical activity in your brain rises and falls at a rate of 8 to 12 cycles per second. Those are called alpha waves. That's what the rider's EEG headset is reading. It's, of course, a little more complicated than this, but basically, the stronger your alpha waves are and the longer you can hold them, the higher up the winch lifts you.
But it also creates an intense experience for the person who's the rider, and they have to let go of all of this information and rise above everything that's happening in the room. So it's really a storm of stimulation that's happening that you have to focus through.
Doing it in the actual ascent, I use imagery to get me to a place.
That's Michelle Stern. She's producer of The Ascent.
And it usually involved swimming, something physical and being aware of my physical center and kind of letting my focus dissolve.
The Ascent was staged earlier this year in New York. When I recently met Duenas, it was in storage, so we ran a small simulation instead. He put a headset on me, wired into a laptop.
So I'm going to reset this, and you'll have 60 seconds to raise this little meter to the top and see if you can trigger the margarita.
Okay, and we're off.
He's made green, folks.
That's Jeremy Halpern, the executive producer of The Ascent.
I distracted him by saying that.
If I reach a relaxed state of mind, it triggers a little light bulb.
He's rising. He's in the blue.
If I hold that relaxed state of mind, a handheld electric fan turns on. And if I keep on holding it long enough, I've ascended.
He's almost halfway up. He's doing incredibly, folks.
The computer triggers a blender filled with ice and margarita mix, although it's only 10 a.m.
He's achieved blenderosity.
And no music?
There we go.
Thank you.
As brainwave technology moves into the hands of artists and designers and creative types, we're going to see a lot more projects similar to The Ascent. A lot more projects that take EEG technology and let people experience something using the power of their mind.
Ariel Garten is the CEO of a Canadian company called Interaxon. Interaxon staged a nationwide art installation using EEGs during the last Winter Olympics at a welcoming pavilion in Vancouver.
There, visitors to the Ontario House could control the lighting on the CN Tower, the Canadian Parliament buildings, and Niagara Falls with their mind from 3,000 kilometers across the country. That's a whole lot of miles, too.
People are now developing wheelchairs that are guided by EEGs and, inevitably, headsets that control video games. But using EEG as a glorified joystick misses the point, according to Henry Holtzman. He's the chief knowledge officer at MIT's Media Lab.
When people are trying to create these whiz-bang EEG-based interfaces, I think that they're reaching in the wrong direction, where they're trying to make you excited about the power of mind control. And I think about it more as an implicit to sort of figure out what's going on with you, how you're reacting to things, and then take that signal and feed it into how the system works.
One of Holtzman's students, Arlene Ducau, developed something called the Mind Rider. It's a bike helmet that displays the rider's state of mind as a green, yellow, or red light.
Are they happy, on task, concentrating well? In that case, maybe they're, you know, green.
Or if the rider has road rage, you'd know to keep clear.
You can't see what a person is thinking, you know. But if aspects of that can lead to sort of greater understandings and greater empathy for, you know, one person to another, one person to another person who's located remotely, or one person to another species even.
Cat ears.
Sorry?
Cat ears.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
The cat ears are this EEG toy you wear on your head.
They're called the Neko Mimi cat ears, and they're just plain, just absolute out there bonkers.
Yes. Ariel Garten thinks they're more interesting than they sound.
And at first blush, those look like kind of a gimmicky idea. You're controlling some cute fuzzy cat ears with your mind and you look like a cute fuzzy raver. But these things are actually totally brilliant. This is an entirely new level of social signaling. This is a way for somebody to actually see your own state and get a signal and open a channel to you that wasn't there before. So in some ways, it's easy to write off things like, you know, fuzzy ears or levitating balls as gimmicks. But they're pretty fundamental shifts in what we can do and what we can communicate.
Which brings us back to The Ascent. It looks like a gimmick, and it's totally whiz-bang. Yehuda Duenas thinks it's going to be big.
We're really interested in getting to Las Vegas, and we feel like it only benefits from getting more and more ridiculous.
But there's a real idea here. Using EEGs, Duenas makes high drama out of just relaxing. It demonstrates how hard it is to keep your mind clear when you're bombarded with stimulation. Kind of a perfect artwork for 21st century life. For Studio 360, I'm Mark Anderson.
You can see some images from The Ascent at studio360.org. Every year, the Library of Congress picks 25 recorded works to preserve forever in the National Recording Registry. And every December, we highlight a few of the year's selections. To close the show today, the last of our 2012 picks. We'll go back a few decades to the heyday of disco, 1977. Donna Summer released a single that abandoned disco music's funky roots in favor of a driving electronic pulse made by synthesizers. Brian Eno declared famously that it would, quote, change the sound of club music for the next 15 years. How about 35 years and counting? Its thunderbeat and distant ethereal vocals are still the language of dance music. The single was I Feel Love. And here's the story of that record.
My name is Giorgio Moroder. I am a composer from Italy. The connection to I Feel Love is I composed it. Donna Summer and Pete Bellotti wrote the lyrics. And I recorded basically all the tracks.
My name is Eric Weisbart. I teach American Studies at the University of Alabama. I first realized how important I Feel Love is when I was curating a disco music exhibit and quickly realized this was the song that changed how disco sounded forever.
Pete Bellotti and I, we wanted to do an album with some old sounds, some sounds of today, and one kind of a futuristic sound. So the song I Feel Love, it was meant to be the sound of the future. Everything you hear on I Feel Love is electronic. The bass, the hi-hat, the snare, all produced by a synthesizer, which at that time nobody ever did.
I Feel Love is the song that made disco into a music of synthesizers, of machine associations, of a kind of almost post-human quality.
At that time, it was a big, big job because I used only one, the big Moog, and the notes got out of tune. So almost every 10 seconds, I had to tune it again, continue with the recording, tune it again. What Donna did, she started to sing the song very soft. In fact, I think the key for Donna was not the right one. And that was a great thing because her romantic, very soft, sexy voice fitted really nicely to that hard, almost robotic sound of the tracks.
Donna Summer's singing, there's almost like a loud thinness to it. She pushes so hard at the top of her voice that you are amazed and not quite sure what you're hearing.
I did not expect the song I Feel Love to be a big hit because it was on the B-side. But then I think suddenly it started to do well, especially in England. And from England out, it came back to the States and kind of became a big hit in the gay clubs, in the discotheques. And the gay community loved Donna like a goddess.
To me, the legacy of I Feel Love can be heard in those sort of clapping beats, pulsing throughout the song, start to finish. And to a great extent, electronic dance music has been riding that pulse ever since.
When I listen to the record now, I think I could not do it much better. This was supposed to be the sound of the, whatever, 2000. And now we are in 2012 and it's still okay.
That That was composer Giorgio Moroder and musicologist Eric Weisbard talking about Donna Summer's I Feel Love. The song was selected for the National Recording Registry this year, and Donna Summer will be posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next spring. That story comes from Eric Bite and Ben Minella Productions. Earlier in the show, we played an excerpt of Studio 360's supergroup performing Beck's St. Dude. I want to give a shout-out to all the singers and players, John Delore, Rob Christensen, Dylan Keefe, Jason Isaac, John Schaefer, David Garland, Brooke Gladstone, Sotirios Johnson, Jenny Lawton, Terrence McKnight, Lital Molad, Michelle Siegel, Irene Trudell, and Aya Kato. The amazing video that you can see at studio360.org was shot by Amy Pearl, and John Delore recorded and mixed all the music. We also made recordings of a few other pieces from Songreader, and you can hear those at the website as well. That's it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great Christmas. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Molad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Leibowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
And thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon, who's now almost as old as I am. Our series on the National Recording Registry received support from the Library of Congress, and our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we look back a century to 1913.
It was the beginning of a century of absolute chaos. As so often, the artists heard it and reflected it first.
In New York and Paris and all over, people were confronted with new art and music that seemed weird, ugly, wrong. Culture Shock 1913, a special edition of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.